everyone. Thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
We're not going to shy away or apologize for who we are.
Mayor Johnson hits back after the Department of Justice announces an investigation into the city's hiring practices. Our Spotlight Politics team has the latest. And what the city's doing to address Chicago's massive affordable housing shortage. We sit down with the city's housing commissioner. And now to some of today's top stories. A key city council committee advances a controversial curfew proposal today. The measure would allow Chicago Police Department officials to preemptively impose a curfew anywhere in the city and begin enforcing it with just 30 minutes notice. The proposal, backed by Police Superintendent Larry Snelling, is an effort to stop large teen gatherings. Mayor Brandon Johnson questions the measure's constitutionality and says he does not believe expanding the city's curfew would stop the gatherings from turning violent.
Do I have concerns? Of course I do. You know, but, you know, the, you know, historic nature of what we're confronting is going to take all of us collectively to ensure that we are addressing and approaching this matter in the fullness of all of the experiences that the people of Chicago have had. So
the measure now heads to the full city council for a vote tomorrow. Survivors of sexual abuse by Catholic priests are accusing Pope Leo of covering up clergy sex abuse cases over the years, and now that he's Pope, are calling for him to do more.
This is the side of him and his management and his decisions that we're finally being able to bring to light, because it's about the whole man. That's what's important. And what we care about is what he has done or not done about the sexual abuse of children.
The group, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP, says they have new documents from the Pope's time as Bishop of the Diocese of Chiclayo in Peru. They believe the new documents directly implicate the former Cardinal Robert Prevost in mishandling abuse reports then and in other roles across the church. SNAP is calling on Pope Leo to establish a global truth commission, adopt a universal zero-tolerance law into canon law, and create a reparations fund, among other steps. Thus far, Pope Leo has made no public statements about sexual abuse or cover-ups. An anonymous donation is making it possible for Northwestern University to expand its Jewish studies programming. The university isn't revealing the amount of the donation that arrives amid the Trump administration's investigations over allegations of discrimination and harassment targeting Jewish students on campus. In a statement, Northwestern President Michael Schill says, quote, "Recent events in our world highlight the urgent need for more education about Judaism and the experiences of Jewish people, and an emphasis on making sure Jewish students always feel a sense of belonging at Northwestern." The new donation will help expand teaching, allow more students to enroll in courses about Jewish culture, and will grow events and programming in collaboration with Northwestern Hillel. The Chicago Sky's season opener posted up record-breaking viewership. Angel Reese and the Sky might have lost to Caitlin Clark in the Indiana Fever, but the game drew an average of 2.7 million viewers, making it the most watched WNBA game on ESPN platforms. That's all despite the flagrant fouls and alleged racial slurs that the league is reportedly investigating. That same day, the games between the Las Vegas Aces and the New York Liberty also netted an average of 1.3 million viewers. Chicago native George Wendt has died. The actor and comedian was best known for appearing in every episode of the long-running sitcom Cheers as the affable barfly Norm Peterson, and for appearing as one of the Chicago Bears superfans on Saturday Night Live. He honed his comedic chops at the famed Second City, where he also met his future wife. Wendt appeared on Chicago Tonight in 2015 when he came to town to perform in a play with fellow Second City alum Tim Kazurinsky. Here he is remembering one of those sketches.
We had these ridiculous cowboy outfits because, you know, it was just find whatever you can backstage at Second City. Bruce and I got the only two guns, so Tim improvised and used a blow dryer. as a gun. And we just started riding, and we thought, you know what, we'll just ride as long as we can, and as soon as they stop laughing, we'll start to improvise. We'll do some sort of scene. Well, they never stopped laughing, so we just never did anything. And then we ran it a couple of times.
George Wendt was 76 years old. Coming up next, a one-on-one with the city's housing commissioner on the mayor's green social housing initiative, federal funding cuts, and much more. And later in the program, Congresswoman Lauren Underwood announces she's not running for Senate. Our Spotlight Politics team on how that race is shaping up.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabey family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Amid rising costs and threats to federal housing grants, Chicago is facing a shortfall of nearly 120,000 affordable housing units. Mayor Brandon Johnson's new Green Social Housing Initiative aims to address that shortage by creating a city-owned nonprofit housing developer. The Chicago Department of Housing is now tasked with carrying out the mayor's vision to expand housing opportunities for residents. Joining us now is the commissioner for the Chicago Department of Housing, Lizette Castañeda. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me here, Brenda.
So you write in a Chicago Tribune op-ed that affordable housing is a misunderstood issue. What do you think is misunderstood?
I think for a lot of people, the very basic of the idea of, like, what does it mean to have affordable housing? Who is affordable housing for? Is one of those things that is often seen as for poor people or for others. But at its core, affordable housing is just about, can you afford your rent or your mortgage and utilities without being rent burdened? In Chicago, 51% of renters are rent burdened, which means that they're paying more than 30% of their income. What we're looking for is a Chicago in which it is affordable for everyone to rent or own a home.
How is creating more affordable housing for those who need it, how is that beneficial to the rest of Chicago?
Affordable housing is economic development. When we are able to have affordable housing, when any one of us is able to afford the home in which we live, we are able to spend on local businesses, we're able to contribute to the local economy, and generally be part of a stable community.
The mayor's Green Social Housing Initiative, it was recently passed in City Council, of course, creating a city-owned nonprofit housing developer. It would offer low-interest loans to developers with the goal of building 400 affordable units annually. 30% of each project must also be permanently affordable for households earning less than 80% of the area median income. Tell us about the steps that your department has to take to deliver on this initiative.
Yeah, absolutely. We're really excited that we were able to come to a place with City Council in which we were able to get this passed. This will mean that we will be able to add to the production of affordable housing units every year, in addition to what we were able to provide through low-income housing tax credits. So now that we have authorization from City Council, we're going to be able to seat the next board, the new board, in order to get them confirmed by City Council and get them started on looking at deals and really getting this rolling out.
There's still a concern, though, over which neighborhoods will be developed and that low-income neighborhoods might be left out. How are you all addressing that?
Yeah, we really think of green social housing as a citywide initiative. We know that there are some places where we will be able to begin with our projects, but at the end of the day, we know that eventually we will be able to have a green social housing project in each of the city's 77 community areas.
Chicago would also be the biggest city to create this nonprofit housing development. And sometimes when you're the first at something, it's a risky undertaking. Why do you think this makes sense for the city?
Yeah, so this is an innovative but proven model. It is true that Chicago is the biggest city to take this on, but at the end of the day, other cities have taken this on and we're just doing it at a larger scale. We fully believe that there is a desire out there for low-cost capital that can really create not just the affordable units, but the market units that the city also needs.
The developer is only slated to build 400 units a year, and as we've discussed, Chicago's need is much greater than that. Why not focus on building more homes faster?
Yeah, so the 400 units would actually be the number of affordable units. So that is actually the 30% of the total number of units that we would be looking to build in total. And so we are looking to build faster. The Department of Housing's other big undertaking has been to participate diligently in Mayor Johnson's Cut the Tape effort, which aims to get affordable housing with shovels in the ground faster and at a pace that is necessary to keep up with demand in the city.
So then, I mean, there's obviously the housing that would come as a result of the Green Social Housing Initiative, but it sounds like you're also saying the Cut the Tape initiative would encourage other developers to contribute to the affordable housing shortage as well.
That is correct. The idea is that green social housing is one tool in the toolbox, but we have many tools in the toolbox that work in different neighborhoods. And at the end of the day, green social housing is part of our growing the pie strategy. So through Cut the Tape, we are ensuring that our other tools in the toolbox are also working at their best and highest use in order to deliver the units that we need in the city.
Some alders have said, you know, this is a good start, but this does not solve all of our affordable housing needs. What more is there? What else do you need?
Absolutely, and we would wholeheartedly agree. We have a unit shortage of almost 120,000 units in the city of Chicago. And again, this is one tool in the toolbox and one way in which we are addressing it. We also need to do more for homeowners and helping to figure out how to help people who want to buy a home be able to afford to do that. We need to build more and we need to build faster. And other tools, such as continuing to use our low-income housing tax credit resources, will help us achieve that.
Let's talk a little bit about aldermanic prerogative, which lets alder people decide what gets built in their wards and what doesn't, of course. During the Biden administration, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development found that it fuels segregation in Chicago, violating the civil rights of Black and Latino residents by limiting the creation of affordable housing. What is the status of ongoing negotiations to resolve that probe?
Yeah, because there are ongoing negotiations. Unfortunately, we can't comment on the ongoing legal matter, but there are ongoing negotiations.
I mean, and to that point, though, what is your office doing to ensure that the creation of affordable housing does not contribute to the city's segregation issues?
Yeah, I think initiatives like Green Social Housing are actually a really great example of our ability to build in various parts of the city, including parts of the city that have traditionally not had enough affordable housing. It also is a really good indication of our ability to work with elected officials to ensure that we are able to reach a point where it is something that we're able to do in all community areas, in all wards, because we can get to a good point of partnership.
Building costs have continued to rise as the city is still, of course, continuing to build affordable housing units. And you may not necessarily have control over those costs, obviously, but what are you doing to ensure that as we get closer to the end of any project, the budget hasn't ballooned beyond affordability?
Yeah, absolutely. So this has been a huge part of our Cut the Tape work, which is how do we maintain a minimum standard? How do we say that we don't just want units that are good enough, but that are good and decent units that families can live in? At the same time, how do we ensure that costs are not skyrocketing. And so part of our work through the Cut the Tape initiative has been an update of the Architectural and Technical Standards Manual, which will have some updated ways in which we will be looking at cost controls and also at continuing to be able to move faster. Because ultimately, one of the biggest things that is a challenge to projects and makes them more expensive is time. And so we're really trying to address how do we make these things move faster.
And we've mentioned it a couple of times. I want to be sure our viewers know what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. The Cut the Tape initiative, explain for them, please, what this does, because you all also shared a year report earlier this week.
Just on Monday, we celebrated the one-year anniversary of the Cut the Tape initiative launch. Cut the Tape is based on an executive order that Mayor Johnson signed in December of 2023, where he asked 14 different city departments to work together on streamlining processes and figuring out what is getting in the way of development.
Are there any concerns that actions taken by the Trump administration might impact the costs of the work that you're planning?
Sure. I think that, you know, like anything, you know, I was listening in the car on the way here, and there's a lot of conversations about tariffs. Those things are certainly a concern for us. Also, the federal administration's budget from a couple of weeks ago, their initial sort of volley included cuts to things that are really important to us, like community development block grants and home investment partnership funding. Those are all ways in which we advance affordable housing, and so we're certainly keeping a close eye on where those negotiations end up in Congress.
What's next? What's next for your office and, of course, for this new initiative?
Yeah, so the very next thing, of course, is, again, to seat the board of Green Social Housing and make sure that we can get deals in front of us. It's to release our updated architectural and technical standards manual and to continue some of the work that has already begun earlier this year and other initiatives such as Rebuild 2.0, where we are taking vacant land and vacant buildings and ensuring that we are turning them back into good and productive use for neighborhoods on the south and west sides.
Okay. Building Commissioner Lisette Castaneda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Of course. Up next, the fast approaching budget deadline facing state lawmakers. Our Spotlight Politics team on that and much more right after this. The latest on a renewed push to allow Chicago police to declare snap curfews, the Department of Justice says it's investigating the city's hiring practices, and a veteran Illinois lawmaker is ousted from his committee chairmanship after upsetting party leaders. Here with all that and more is our Spotlight Politics team, Heather Sharone and Nick Blumberg. Hey, gang. So, hello. So, as we heard at the top of the show, the City Council's Public Safety Committee voting 10-7 to send this revised plan to give the Chicago Police the power to impose a curfew. That is going to go to the full City Council tomorrow for a final vote, what's called a snap curfew. Heather, what changed?
Well, the original proposal required Police Superintendent Larry Snelling and Deputy Mayor Gary Ann Gatewood to agree that they needed to declare a snap curfew to prevent a teen gathering from getting out of hand. That changed in the version that advanced through the committee today. Now, Larry Snelling has the unilateral power to determine the snap curfew, and that caused Alderman Jason Irvin, a member of the City Council's Black Caucus, to pull his support. He was actually a co-sponsor of this measure, saying that that concentrates too much power in one person's hands. Tomorrow's vote, I expect, will be very close.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a contentious one because despite Jason Irvin pulling his support, it still passed. 10-7.
That is a relatively narrow victory in a committee vote. Also, the Public Safety Committee has a lot of the City Council's most conservative and self-proclaimed pro-police alder people. So its fate will really depend tomorrow on how many members of the Progressive Caucus can bring members of the Black Caucus to their side and reject this measure.
Yeah, obviously, a lot of folks, including the mayor, have raised questions about the constitutionality of this. But just from a purely, you know, sort of policy perspective, it's interesting to see this revised proposal move away from a power-sharing model. You have to imagine that's going to be a big factor, not just for Irvin, but for a lot of other alders as they're considering their votes.
Yeah, that was a surprising one also. So Mayor Brandon Johnson fiercely defending his decision to appoint what he says is the, quote, most racially diverse cabinet in Chicago history. This is, of course, a day after the Trump administration announces that the DOJ has launched an investigation to see if city officials are engaging in a pattern of practice or of discrimination based on race. Here's a little of what the mayor had to say about that at a news conference this morning.
My administration reflects the country, it reflects the city. His administration reflects the country club. We're not going to be intimidated by the tyranny that's coming from the federal government. The diversity of our city is our strength. And so when
people... Heather, what prompted this investigation from the DOJ?
Well, Mayor Brandon Johnson has been making a point to appear at many local churches on the South Side, and he spoke at Bishop Brazier's church in Woodlawn, and he is has been, for the whole 2 years he's in office, been very proud of how many black people are in leadership positions at City Hall. There was nothing different that he said last night that he hadn't said 6 months ago or 9 months ago or a year ago. But what's different, of course, is the Trump administration's crackdown on so-called DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. They heard Mayor Johnson's statements and said, oh-ho, is that racial discrimination against white people? And that's what prompted the Department of Justice's civil rights decision to launch this probe, saying essentially that they suspect that Brandon Johnson has violated the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which of course was the legislation that ensured that Jim Crow was no longer the law of the land in the southern states.
You have to wonder whether Trump officials are really just watching the mayor and I'm sure other, big city Democratic mayors very closely, because this was not the kind of comment that made national news. This was not getting splashed on, CNN.
Made local news.
Exactly. So, in an informal chat like this, it seems they have him under a microscope, and you have to imagine he is not the only one.
Well, they also have the help of social media. This immediately sort of made the rounds of all of the X accounts, the quote, end wokeness account almost immediately posted what the mayor said. And we have seen time and time again the Trump administration taking their cues from conservative influencers and people active specifically on X, formerly known as Twitter. And this is another example of something that's risen to the sort of attention of the social media world that was quickly jumped on by the Trump administration.
Nick, you're heading to Springfield next week as the Illinois General Assembly. They've got to hammer out this budget by the May 31st deadline, of course, and we know money is tight. What are you expecting to see next week?
Absolutely. That's going to be a huge factor, as we've been talking about on the show. $500 million in revenues revised down. That makes an already tough budget year even tougher. And I think a lot of reporters and probably a lot of politicians themselves are going to be paying close attention to just how long this process takes, just how late they walk it up to the deadline. We've seen in many years past, even in easier budget years, that this process to put together a spending plan and a revenue plan can take a long time, and also to get both those plans passed. We saw last year it took several rounds of voting to have enough members present, enough Dems present, because some of them peeled off, to get that spending plan passed. We've heard from leadership that they think they've got the process more buttoned up this year. They think it's not going to be quite so difficult to make sure all those votes are actually physically present when needed. But I think a lot of folks are going to be looking at both the, the revenue and spending, how that all comes together, as well as the logistics of the process.
How do we think some of the Chicagoland priorities are going to fare? Of course, like transit funding, money from CPS, because we know they're asking for more as usual.
They are. And in fact, Chicago Teachers Union members are going back down to Springfield. They've been down several times and heading down again yesterday to lobby and lobby lawmakers and rally. Among the things they're calling for is additional funding for CPS. I think a lot of observers say any additional money from the city or state to help CPS with that reported $500 million deficit is pretty unlikely. As for transit, it's still a big lift. They're looking both at governance reform, and they've started to take a harder look at some of the revenue issues here. They've been meeting regularly just a couple days ago. The stakeholders and lawmakers put their heads together on this. So there does seem to be a bit more optimism on the transit side of things, that this is something that could get resolved this month, that they're not necessarily going to kick it down the road to the veto session in the fall. But I will be as curious as anybody to see where that goes.
I'm sure. And this is something that we also discussed just last night here on the show, as you said, with Senator DeWitt and Representative LaShawn Ford. So the Senate race, U.S. Representative Lauren Underwood, she says that she is not running to replace Senator Dick Durbin. Heather, did she say why? What did she say about why?
Well, she says she wants to stay in the House and to help Democrats reclaim the House. She is a member of the Democratic leadership, and her job in this upcoming midterm cycle will be to recruit candidates who can run for seats now held by Republicans and win those seats back, because everybody's talking about the big budget debate in Washington right now. Republicans only have a 5-vote majority. So a lot of these contested races will determine who controls the House after the 26th elections. And Lauren Underwood says she can have a bigger impact and do a better job of standing up to Trump rather than jumping into the already crowded Senate race.
And of course, she responded to some speculation yesterday about whether or not the governor had an influence. What did she say about
that?
She
said, no, not so much. And the governor has said, I wasn't trying to push her out of the race, although he is firmly behind Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, as is Senator Tammy Duckworth. So nobody thinks he's sort of objective in this race, but he doesn't necessarily want to get crosswise with Representative Underwood.
Not so much, no. Nick, veteran Illinois lawmaker Fred Crespo from Hoffman Estates, he's been ousted from his committee chairmanship after upsetting Democratic leadership. What did he do to earn that ire?
Well, this is, the second year in the row. He is a, fiscally conservative Democrat, and he, again, was putting together a more, what he sees as a more fiscally conservative spending plan, not necessarily making cuts, but withholding funding in this upcoming budget for, certain of the different budget buckets in the budget there to try and preserve things, he says, like health insurance for folks who most need it. But, to hear State House Leader Chris Welch tell it, it wasn't just that Crespo was coming up with potentially alternative plans, it's that he wasn't communicating. He was not doing his job, as a member, as a committee leader. And that was ultimately what Welch says is what earned him that ire.
All right. That is Spotlight Politics. Heather Cerrone, Nick Blumberg, thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this Tuesday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, for more backstory on the biggest stories of the day. That is at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. From police community relations to DEI pledges, a look at where the country is 5 years after the murder of George Floyd. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.